All right, welcome to the next edition of our speaker series. This is John Patika Jr. with the Patika Wealth Management Group down here in Clearwater, Florida. And we're introducing the next installment of our UBS Innovation Series, where we're celebrating 250 years of United States innovation. The title of this episode and the new report is A Great Future in Plastics. And we'll explore how credit cards have evolved from just a simple piece of plastic into a global payment infrastructure, and how the evolution is creating investment opportunities today. And I'm joined today with Jeff Harwood, and he's a leading contributor from the Chief Investment Office covering banks, asset managers, payments and processing companies, and also lead contributor on this report. So Jeff, it's great to have you today. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah. And Jeff, can you walk us through the history of credit cards and how that infrastructure developed over time, and definitely how that impact of the new technology had with the global economy? I mean, it was a major innovation in its time.
Sure, yeah. It's really a fascinating story, because the development of the general purpose credit card was not at all a well thought out initiative. It was much more of just a novel experiment. So if we go back in history, we had the Diners Club card, but that wasn't really a general purpose card. That was just a charge card that you had to pay off every month, and it was used only at restaurants. So it wasn't general purpose. You couldn't use it really anywhere else. But back in 1958, Bank of America came up with the idea of a general purpose card, and their way of testing it out was to simply send out 60,000 credit cards to Fresno, California. And so residents just woke up one day, they had these credit cards, didn't really know what they were, but Bank of America had been working in the background with merchants in the area to set up this kind of network of acceptance. And so these residents took their cards, they used them at the businesses, kind of got used to the whole credit card idea, but Bank of America didn't have any underwriting standards. There was no credit card application, no credit scores. So early on, losses were much, much higher than what Bank of America had expected. So it was not a profitable business at all, but they didn't shut it down, because they found out that the residents in Fresno really liked this idea of a general purpose credit card. So Bank of America went back, they, in their underwriting standards, they actually got the program to turn a profit after a few years. And then they decided to expand this program. But back in this, you know, started in 1958, so back in the 50s and 60s, banks couldn't operate across state borders. So Bank of America decided to license this Bank of America card across state lines to different banks and financial institutions. And what this created actually was this large network. So they had the Bank of America card in Fresno, they had it in different states, but it was all kind of the same idea. And what they did kind of almost by accident was build this huge acceptance network that eventually evolved into what we know today as Visa. They had gained so much success throughout the 50s and 60s and the 70s that at that same time, there was a rival network being built with the same idea. And that eventually turned into MasterCard. And so that's kind of the genesis of those two credit card networks and how they built this kind of giant network of acceptance. And on the kind of economic standpoint, this evolution was really helpful during the post-war economic expansion. It helped to extend that and make it even stronger, mainly by boosting consumer spending. So with the kind of advent of these credit cards and the acceptance, it was just much easier for consumers to spend. This also brought more transactions into the real economy. So it went from cash transactions to card transactions. And this actually resulted in incremental tax revenues also. So like I said, a really fascinating story, from a novel experiment to this huge network of acceptance to also kind of improving the macro backdrop and tax revenues.
Yeah, that is incredible. And after COVID-19, you know, a lot of consumer behaviors changed, and there's a lot more buying on e-commerce. And I know, you know, when I get home from work, I feel like there's a box at the door every afternoon. And it's so easy with the click of a button to actually purchase things nowadays. But can we talk about how that consumer behavior has shifted and how it impacted like the payments ecosystem?
Yeah. And it really, I mean, the biggest change was around COVID. At first, you know, we all pulled back in our spending. We didn't really know what was happening, didn't know what was going to come next. And so spending broadly really dipped. As everyone got more comfortable in the new environment, we started spending again. Volumes in total went back up. However, we still weren't fully back socially. So e-commerce volumes spiked in 2020 and 2021 relative to pre-COVID levels. And what was really interesting about that is that there was really no visible change at the consumer level because we were still just buying things. It was just online or on our phone. Like you mentioned, packages just show up. And what this really did was just highlight the scale of the networks and the capabilities they built and the capabilities that scale really enables. And these are huge networks operating mainly in the background, but they're also oddly nimble. And so it helped enable that shift in consumer behavior. Now, you know, we're all very comfortable just using e-commerce, buying stuff on our phones. And we don't really think twice about it. I think it just highlights the scale and the capabilities of the networks.
Yeah, I don't think I could ever get to the point where I'm just walking around with my phone with no wallet and be comfortable with it. But I guess I'm an older millennial.
Right.
But, it certainly has changed. But can we talk a little bit about the payment systems like Venmo and Zelle? And you see these popping up and all the, like, in different banks. Like, how do these payment companies, how do they make money?
So Zelle is actually part of the banking system at this point. So it's similar to how Visa was built up through this network of different banks. Zelle is kind of the same idea. It's a consortium of the largest banks. And all it really is just a way for consumers to move money from account to account. So it's not really meant for profit. So I don't think there's any revenue attached to it. It's more of just providing a service that clients had wanted. Venmo, on the other hand, is part of PayPal, and that does have some revenue related to it. I believe it's mostly just net interest income from people leaving money in their Venmo account that enables PayPal to earn some interest on that income or on that cash, and that generates net interest income. But really, these services aren't meant as much for a profit, but more so just kind of client retention and providing the services the client wants and then eventually cross-selling other services.
Interesting. Yeah, I had no idea that that's the purpose, and Zelle really wasn't, you know, a profit center. But let's kind of switch gears here and just kind of talk about, you know, the future of payments. Like, where do you see, you know, this credit card companies and how they're evolving and people changing their behavior to more digital? Like, what do you think the future might look like from here?
Yeah, so the card ecosystem has really been really good at evolving. It started with the electromagnetic stripes they added to cards back in like the 70s and 80s. And more recently, to your point, with like e-commerce, they've added the chips to the cards, which is really adopted earlier in Europe and international markets. But then also tokenization, which is, both of these are really just kind of fraud prevention tools. But both of these really improve the customer experience, especially during this post-COVID environment where e-commerce is more important. You know, I've kind of mentioned this, where you can, you know, tap your phone to pay now, or you can tap your card to pay now. That's not just making things a little bit simpler, but it's also fraud prevention, because the technology behind that makes it harder for fraudsters to, I forget the term, kind of steal your card information. But looking ahead, the new technologies that I'm kind of focusing on right now relate to stablecoin and agentic commerce. So on stablecoin, the really use cases here in our view are related to cross-border transactions, really remittances and cross-border B2B transactions. So on remittances, this is just if you've got family overseas and you want to send money, it might be much easier to do it via stablecoin, which is instantaneous and takes away all of the foreign exchange volatility risks. And it's just instantaneous. So instead of like sending a money order, it's just done immediately. And then on the cross-border commercial payments, kind of the same idea, especially for businesses that might be operating in areas that have higher foreign exchange volatility. Instead of worrying about hedging your FX risk or dealing with converting your money to a certain currency to pay your vendor, you could potentially just use stablecoin to, again, settle instantaneously, not avoid, or you can avoid the, you know, multi-day settlements, which could be impacted by FX volatility. And so that kind of makes more sense. We've seen Visa and MasterCard kind of lean into this as well. They're both already operating different stablecoin programs. But again, this is concentrated a little bit more in areas that might not have developed payment ecosystems already and have higher fixed volatility. And then on agentic commerce, go ahead.
Before you move to that on the stablecoin, I am a little bit, I guess, ignorant when it comes to these things. You know, you got the Bitcoins and the Tethers and the stablecoins. I don't really understand the difference. Like, what is a stablecoin? Is that's backed by the US dollar?
Yeah, so it's backed by assets. So they're typically, for the most part, they're linked to the U.S. dollar, but they actually have collateral backing the coins themselves. So typically, it's going to be U.S. treasuries or other very safe assets.
Interesting.
Whereas
so that
crypto
would be the
difference. Yeah, whereas like Bitcoin has nothing backing it besides just kind of trust and kind of technology, but there's no actual asset. So if you want to convert your stablecoin to back to dollars, like there's assets you can sell to back that stablecoin.
Gotcha. Well, that makes a lot more sense to me than a Bitcoin that is value is only as what someone's willing to pay for it.
I think the volatility in both of those asset clusters kind of reflects that view.
Yeah. And the agentic commerce, please speak on that. I feel like I've heard that word being thrown around a lot, this agentic AI, agentic commerce. So yeah, could you please explain what's going on there?
Yeah, the simplest example, I think, and the most common example is you want to book a vacation. You don't want to do all the research on which is the best flight, what is the best hotel, what event or what, you know, activities can we do around this trip. So you might just enable an agent to do this for you. So you provide the payment information and you say, here's what I want to do, here's where I want to go, book the things that make the most sense and save me X amount of money. So again, it's very simplistic, but that's kind of the idea. And then if you think about that from a broader context where businesses can do this, and you can do it in other consumer areas, it's actually pretty interesting from a broader macro standpoint as well. But the narrative here for the payment system is that for the payment companies is that the big networks could end up being disrupted because of new technologies that are introduced that displace the MasterCards and the Visas. We kind of think that's a bit misguided, though, because as we've highlighted, Visa and MasterCard have the size and the scale and the capabilities that no other network has. And this potentially positions them to be beneficiaries and also enablers of agentic commerce. Because in the example that I laid out, you're probably going to give your credit card information to the travel agent, the agentic, you know, the AI agent, and then they're going to go book everything you need to do. So it's not as though there's going to be an entirely new payment system unless you want to use Bitcoin to pay for it or stablecoin or some of these other newer technologies. But it seems like given the volatility, that might not be the best idea. But so then there is a narrative that Visa and MasterCard and some of the credit card companies are going to get disrupted. I don't think it makes a ton of sense. On top of just being able to enable some of this, a key part of everything we just talked about relates to security and trust. You're not going to give your credit card to something that you don't trust. And so Visa and MasterCard have built up decades of experience and a track record having the best security and the best trust, and it's still very important in agentic commerce. So I think that the existing networks are in a very good position to help enable some of that technology.
Well, hopefully they have some guardrails on that for when my daughter becomes a teenager, because I could imagine that can get out of hand.
So
taking a step back, let's talk about your current view on financials, particularly banks and payment processing companies as far as an investment opportunity. And we really wanted to get your thoughts on how you see the landscape out there.
Sure. So for the financial sector as a whole, we do have a favorable view. And this is driven by three key themes. One, profitability metrics are increasing across most of the sector. Two, capital markets activity is increasing, which benefits a lot of the financial sector as well. And then three, deregulation tailwinds still exist. And then for banks specifically, all three of those tailwinds are helping the banking space. The rate curve is driving better net interest margins, which helps profitability. Capital markets activity is picking up, which obviously helps the investment banks. And then deregulation has been largely positive for the banks as well. So we just got the Basel III endgame proposal. I won't dig into the weeds here, but it's been a long time coming. It creates formal rules for capital requirements for the banks. They've been waiting for several years to get these rules. Finally getting clarity on these capital rules should enable banks to deploy significant amounts of excess capital they already hold. And so that likely means higher buybacks, higher dividends, and more ability to invest in growth initiatives, which translates into higher earnings over time. So we're positive on the banks still. And then in the payment space, a little bit less constructive here outside of the networks. The networks still have a wide moat given their market position and the capabilities we've talked about. They've built up the experience over several decades. The other areas of the payments ecosystem, though, are looking increasingly commoditized. It seems that many of the companies are stuck in this same kind of cycle where they're either going to be cutting their prices to generate more spend growth, or they're going to be sacrificing growth to protect their margins. And some of the valuations across the space do kind of reflect that dynamic. But overall, definitely a little bit more constructive on the networks, which is some of the other pieces of the payments ecosystem.
Do you have a preference between the big banks, the mid-sized banks, and then the smaller community banks? I know the smaller banks kind of got crushed there a few years back, but where do you see the value, you know, amongst the size of banks?
So the big banks are likely going to be bigger beneficiaries of AI. So longer term, I think that, you know, they're still going to benefit significantly from efficiencies, productivity, things like that from the AI standpoint. The regional banks, though, on a valuation standpoint, screen a little bit more attractive here. And if we continue to see a resilient macro environment, I do think that there's potential for outperformance in the regional banks versus the larger banks over the more near and intermediate term.
And you spoke on, just mentioned artificial intelligence. Let's talk about that, because that's like the hottest topic. Every time you turn on the TV, yeah, everybody's got ChatGPT, I feel. It's impacting many sectors in the economy. And how is it influencing banking and financial services? I know just here in my seat, it has completely made things more streamlined and more efficient on my end. But how do you see it, and how influential do you see it going across the board to the different banks?
Yeah, I think big banks are definitely AI winners. The market has kind of decided who's an AI winner and who's an AI loser based on their own perception. But banks so far are AI winners. They are investing heavily. Obviously, back office efficiencies are going to be a key focus area for AI. But also, there's a lot of revenue opportunities, just a lot of productivity enhancements, which, like you mentioned, you can see those across the organization. And so this better productivity across the enterprise is going to be significant for the big banks just because of the diversity of their businesses. Regional banks are also going to be winners, though, just to a little bit of a lesser scale, in part because they simply don't have the AI budget or the tech budget that a UBS or a JP Morgan might have. But they're still going to see some of the same benefits too, both on the back end and the front end. And I think that's what's different around this kind of technology evolution. Typically, for the banking system, you just see benefits on the back end where you cut costs somewhere. But the difference here is that we're also seeing a lot of revenue opportunities and just productivity across each different segment of the business.
I know in my seat, you know, UBS has pumped out so much research, and just trying to find that research was a task in itself. But now with the tools at hand, I could find exactly what I want, consolidating reports, and to get our clients all of the information right there at the tip of your fingers pretty quickly. So it is amazing. And, you know, I think it's going to obviously continue to get smarter. But let's kind of pivot here and just talk about, you know, the health of the U.S. consumer. You know, you always hear about a K-shaped economy and the wealth gap. And, you know, obviously, you know, big banks like Wells Fargo and Bank of America, I mean, they need the consumer to go out there and spend. But how do you see the health of the U.S. consumer?
Yeah, in one word, it's they're resilient. And surprisingly so, to be quite frank. But the K-shaped economy, that's certainly a real thing. That's something that we're seeing across, you know, the entire economy. So that's real. But we heard from the banks, actually, and the credit card companies over the last 2 weeks during earnings season, and they had a lot of commentary and a lot of data points related to the health of the consumer. And it really just reinforced that idea that there's more resilience than I think a lot of people expected. So we're seeing spending volumes that are solid. We're seeing consumer credit trends that remain stable. So delinquencies and net charge-offs, those trends are showing no signs of weakening right now. And we actually get monthly data from the credit card companies also. So we do track delinquencies and losses pretty closely on a monthly basis. And obviously, a topic right now, too, is gas prices and what kind of impact is that having on the consumer. And overall, what we heard from the banks and the credit card companies is that it's not much of an impact at all yet, partly because spending on gas is still only like low single digits of total consumer spending. So it's not like it's a big part of most people's budgets. Wells Fargo actually provided some interesting data. They said that before gas prices increased in March and April, gas spending for their clients, for their consumer clients, was 6% of debit spend and 4% of credit spend. And they said that 2 weeks ago when they reported earnings, that had jumped just 1% each. So now it was 7% of debit spend and 5% of credit spend. So even though there was a sharp increase in gas prices, it only increased the volume of spending by 1%, broadly speaking. Now, obviously, that's going to be a higher share of spending for lower income households. But the credit data still suggests that credit trends are broadly stable to favorable right now. And for us, looking ahead, the labor market is still the number one driver of consumer credit trends. So we're going to continue to watch that closely. We're still seeing weekly jobless claims that look quite strong. then we'll obviously watch the monthly jobs report as well, including some other alternative data that we track on a regular basis. But right now, things look broadly stable so far.
All right, that's good. Jeff, can you touch on private credit and what's happening in that space? I know there's been some news headlines on the TV of redemptions and cracks in the system. Could you talk about what's going on in the private credit space?
Yeah, there's a lot happening. So far, I'll just say it's been largely headline-driven and not as much fundamental-driven right now. But if we go back to fall of last year is when this noise really, really started, there were a few high-profile credit losses. Importantly, not all those were actually private credit. Some of those were bank-led loans. It's just, despite what the press said, you know, they just kind of ran with it, just calling it private credit. So there's a blurred line as to what's private credit and what's not. But that's a different topic, I think. But most of those credit losses were also actually fraud. So that's not indicative of weakening macro trends broadly. That was just kind of, it's fraud. But this year, after the fraudulent losses of last year, AI risk really started to pick up in February, and that hit software valuations. And the idea there being that AI is going to disrupt the entire software space. And that matters to private credit because software makes up a meaningful portion of some of these portfolios. Sometimes over 30 or 40% of a portfolio can be in software. For the bigger managers, it's not anywhere near that. It's typically closer to like 10 or 15%. But for some of these private credit funds, the allocations are pretty high to software. So if some of those software companies are disrupted by AI, then they won't be able to pay their debts and private credit losses will spike. That, again, that's all very simplified, but it's been the story and there have been tons of headlines and articles about that. And this combination of high-profile losses from fall of last year to the AI risk that started in February and is still ongoing, and then all of these issues being amplified by headlines and articles, that has led to a spike in redemptions from investors, which you mentioned. So investors are now pulling some of their funds, pulling some of their investments from some of these private credit funds. This trend so far has been mostly concentrated in the retail channel. So institutional investors have been much more resilient and not as worried. But these redemptions did force some of the funds to cap their redemptions at the 5% caps. And this kind of furthered the whole private credit stress narrative, especially in the press. But if you take a step back, the private credit landscape isn't really all that bad right now. We do expect defaults to pick up over time, but that's also coming off of low levels. So part of that is just typical normalization. And defaults don't mean that loans are just going to zero. Lenders generally recover like 50% of the loans, even after a default. So these defaults also aren't happening all at once. This is likely going to play out over 2 to 3 years. The maturity will really start to pick up in like 2028. So in our view, it's really not that big of a deal right now. And it's certainly not a systemic issue. I mean, I'll just highlight that our fixed income team actually put out a really great note on private credit a couple of weeks ago. But overall, there's a lot going on. It's partly amplified by the press and by headlines, but it is a trend we're going to watch going forward, and we are going to see defaults pick up, but it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a systemic issue out there. And then just quickly for the banks, they do lend to private credit managers, but those loans typically only make up like 2 to 4% of total loans outstanding for the big banks. And these loans are senior and they have significant credit protections embedded in them. So the size and the structure also makes this not really a systemic issue, at least in our view.
Gotcha. Thank you. And I know we're, you know, running close to the end of our time here, but I'm going to ask you one of my last questions, probably one of the most important questions. And I always have a client once that I went through a thing of explaining a particular topic. And he says, "That's great, John, but how do we make money?" So I'm going to ask you, Jeff, how do we invest with everything we just talked about and everything going on here? I know we can't say individual names and we would have to get, and if anybody does, you know, Jeff has a report that we could send to you on the financial sector and in his top picks. But in generalities, how do we invest with some of the themes that you've been talking about today?
Sure. Yeah. So we have recommended taking a balanced approach to investing across financials. And so that means looking at cyclical areas that we like banks and asset managers that have some attractive investment opportunities, but then also taking a look at certain defensive stocks as well, namely in the exchanges area or P&C insurance. We had been recommending a more cyclical tilt for much of last year, but given some of the market volatility and the geopolitical uncertainties going on, we do like having a little bit more balance now.
Okay. Now, your reports, like I said, if anyone listening would like to have Jeff's financial report. You could reach out to the team. We could send it directly to you. And also the report where Jeff was the lead contributor, our latest innovations report on the credit cards. You know, this is one of a series of different innovations that UBS has covered, and our research team has done an amazing job. And we talked about the Transcontinental Railroad, electricity, airlines, you know, and all of a sudden the flight with the Wright brothers and how that changed the world. So if you would like to have any of copies of those reports, please feel free to reach out to our team or go on our website and we'll be able to send that over to you. And before we leave, Jeff, you have any final thoughts before we end our call today?
This has been great. I hope you guys have me back and feel free to reach out anytime.
All right. Well, thank you, Jeff. I appreciate your time with us today. And that will conclude the end of our call. All right, Jeff.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.